At one point, we started talking about like financial stability, and someone brought up the fact that some financial advisor had basically told them, like, well, you could move. You can move to a place where farmland is cheaper. And I just feel like that comes from such a lack of understanding of how important it is to have peers. It's prime hay cutting season. I was amazed by the number of people who came today. Yeah, and frankly, like, very touched that people made the time.
Welcome to the 406th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. While I was participating in a recent pasture walk in the bluff country of southeastern Minnesota, I happened to peek over the shoulder of one of the farmers participating. She had quickly jotted down on a piece of paper a set of calculations. A few yards away, a flock of ewes, along with a pair of guard llamas, were grazing in a hillside paddock. The calculations were in answer to a question the pasture walk's host, Heidi Eager, had asked. How do I make this pasture pay? Around 17 farmers had shown up on this early June day to help Heidi with that and other burning questions. They were all members of one of the Land Stewardship Project's Soil Health Hubs, a collection of four farmer-to-farmer networks representing three regions in southeastern Minnesota and one in northeastern Iowa. These hubs are opportunities for livestock and crop producers to take part in the kind of peer-to-peer learning required to step out of the mainstream and build a farming system based on living, biologically rich soil. Each LSP Soil Health Hub is kept small enough, around a dozen members or so, to make one-to-one connections possible as farmers take turns hosting hub meetings, not as just a kind of show-and-tell exercise, but as a way to address issues such as land access, soil monitoring, weed management, grazing herd profitability, marketing headaches, pasture and cover crop mixes, and ways of wintering livestock. Heidi's hosting of a Soil Health Hub gathering on her Radical Heart Farm in Fillmore County came at a key time for the 34-year-old. This is her eighth year raising sheep in southeastern Minnesota utilizing managed rotational grazing. For 3 years, she was on Nettle Valley Farm, an incubator operation run by veteran livestock grazer Dana Burtness. 5 years ago, Heidi, who's a graduate of LSP's Farm Beginnings course, had an opportunity to move her sheep onto 52 acres of land owned by Pam and Bart Seabach. The Seabachs are very conservation-minded and were looking for someone who could help revitalize soil health and wildlife habitat on the parcel utilizing practices like managed rotational grazing. Heidi and the Seabachs hit it off, and now the young farmer is at the end of a 3-year process of buying the farm, which, besides woods, consists of around 30 acres of hilly pasture. Heidi is excited about owning the land outright, but is also grappling with how to make her farming operation cash flow enough to make loan payments. She direct markets her lamb to consumers, and the demand has been good. But Heidi calculates that she'll need to at least double her 30-head flock in order to get adequate income. One obstacle to increasing sheep numbers is the condition of the farm's pastures. Before she brought her flock there, the land hadn't seen livestock in 15 years. As a result, some of the pastures are suffering from a lack of fertility in the form of manure and are in need of the kind of disturbance grazing ruminants can provide. So, it's no surprise that during the Soil Health Hub meeting she hosted, top of mind for Heidi was how she could increase the capacity of those pastures without doing harm to the soil and vegetation. At one point during the pasture walk, the discussion turned to increasing grazing intensity to help kickstart the biology of the soil. Soil health members literally stepped off the perimeter of an ideal paddock size, while Nikki Meyer, a beef grazer from northeastern Iowa, penciled out the calculations I referred to earlier. Brainstorming doesn't get any more hands-on than that. After the Soil Health Hub gathering, Heidi talked to me about how Farm Beginnings helped her address the weak links in her farming system, creative ways she's gaining access to farmland, and how gophers unearth a surprising amount of soil in a pasture. The young farmer also discussed what it means to have a busy bunch of livestock producers show up during prime haying season to walk her pastures and share a few insights.
So I've been raising sheep for, this is year 8. Okay. I've been on this land for 5 years, and or this is season 5. Before that, I was at Dana Burtness's incubator farm at Nettle Valley. So I've been in the region raising sheep for 8 years. So there's 52 acres, 30-some is pasture, 20-some is woods. And I ended up here when I was with Dana. I wrote up a little land search document, and she sent it out to her network. And the landlords here, Pam and Bart Seabach, had just built a little dwelling, and so they were like, we have pasture, we'd like some animals on it, have really strong care of land is really important to them. And so we spent some time together to make sure we were a good fit, and then I've been renting ever since. I'm at the end of a 3-year process to try and buy the farm, and so far, things are looking good.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. But one of the things you're doing, I really like how you kind of laid it out at the beginning of the meeting today, was you have some questions, and a lot of them are centered around, hey, as it looks like I'm going to be the owner of this farm, I've got to look at how can I pay for this mortgage. And so you're looking at return on investment. How many sheep can I have here? How can I get the best return off of the pasture I have here? So that sounds like that's kind of a, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's kind of the core of a lot of the questions. But yeah, what were kind of, in hosting this, what were some big questions that you kind of wanted folks to kind of field and talk about a little bit?
I took Farm Beginnings, in 2015, and they always talk about, like, identify your weakest link. And so currently my weakest link is pasture quality. In order to be able to pay for the farm, I need to double the sheep flock. From 30 ewes to 60 ewes in 5 years. And right now, with a flock of 30, I'm still running out of grass. Even with last year where we had really beautiful rain and everything was great, growing condition-wise, I still ran out of grass at the end of September. To make this farm work, I need the pasture to improve. And people say, oh, it just takes time. Well, I've got 5 years. I've got a ticking clock. And so really appreciate folks coming out to share what's worked for them and what maybe I could try to sort of speed that improvement along.
And that 5 years, that's the transition period for getting ownership of the farm? Is that what's that ticking time clock?
So my family gave me an incredibly generous loan. I'm doing a farm service agency down payment assistance loan. Mm-hmm. So farm service agency has 45% of the loan, and I'm paying that, or will be, as soon as we close. And then my family gave me a loan where they were willing to delay payments for 5 years. So I need to be able to pay for it when they are ready to have some of their money returned.
When those bills come due, and it's family, so it's even more important, I would say. Can you take us a little bit, this is unfair because, it's like we're taking people through the tour almost again, but we started off at the tour. I think there was a real method to your madness. You kind of wanted to show people. So we went to the first pasture we went to. Can you describe some of the issues that has? But maybe back up even a little bit more. You kind of gave a general view of it had been 15 years since livestock had been on here. And I think you said there's a neighboring dairy farm that had dairy animals on here. And that was the livestock that was here, which is good. But maybe the downside was there was some issues with fertility. And I think some of the people that participated today in the pasture walk talked about, oh, yeah, that makes sense. There was some, when you did soil tests and that, there was already some issues with that soil that were coming out a little bit because of maybe past land management.
Yeah, so the top of the hill in the main pasture is fairly flat. And so the neighborhood suspicion is that someone spread manure there for years and years and years because that was the only place you could safely do it. And so that part of the pasture, which is about 3 acres, it grows the nicest grass, but it's extremely high in potassium and phosphorus. Mm. And then all of the side hills are fairly eroded, were probably overgrazed for generations, and they're extremely low phosphorus and potassium.
So yeah, we started out in that pasture and kind of on the side hill there and walked through a landmine of gophers. And in fact, I got tripped up and fell, which is very embarrassing, but whatever. It was funny to see kind of how it changed a little bit, and people were describing, oh, this is kind of what I'm seeing. I mean, was that useful for you to kind of see people kind of in real time saying, oh, this is why you're seeing a different either species of forage or kind of how dense it is, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's really nice to have other grazers walk with you and like notice the things you're noticing and either have hypotheses about why it's different or just note that it's different. I feel like I haven't gotten that level of attention or detail when I've worked with like NRCS and other technical service providers. So very different to have a group of farmers with you. Nikki was digging in the dirt and she couldn't find an earthworm and she didn't find any ants where she expected them to. And that was really interesting, as I don't ever dig. And so I don't ever think to be like, who's in here? Who's down here? Like, I notice bugs that land on me or are crawling on plants, but don't think about like the insects that live in the soil in the same way. And very interestingly, did note this week that in some of the winter grazed, bale grazed area, there's ants in those gopher mounds. And so then for her to point it out, I was like, wait a minute, I just noticed that over there. And really fun to have all those different measurements of health, be reminded of them or see them in action, which was really great.
Yeah, and you're doing bale grazing on a part of that pasture over there. Can you, we've talked about on this podcast, we've talked about bale grazing before, but can you describe a little, I really find that interesting because it's a hay forage, that the perennial is a perennial forage. But more and more there's this thinking when it comes to soil health that if you're cutting hay off of your ground, some ways you're removing nutrients, but you're buying in hay. And then this idea of bale grazing is you graze your animals, and then that kind of, if there's a area where the soil is depleted, you can kind of build that up. Can you talk about why you were kind of interested in bale grazing a little bit?
We ended up bale grazing in that back pasture. And when I say we, it's me and the sheep, because there was a drought, not last year, but the previous 2 years. And so ran out of grass really dramatically. But it's this great opportunity to import a bunch of carbon, a bunch of fertility, and then the sheep are in this small condensed area for 3 days. And so they're trampling a lot there, they're pooping and peeing a lot there, and so it's this way to really concentrate fertility and kickstart soil biology, which I think is one of the things that's lacking on my pasture. And so they say you get like a 5-year bump in productivity, where it's at the most extreme and the most noticeable, but it is in the sections where we bale grazed, that grass will grow 16 inches while everything else around it is 8. Huh. And so it's this really incredible, like it's a different color. And when the sheep go into those sections, they will graze the bale grazed spots down to the ground before they'll touch anything else. Like it is clearly this like highly nutritious, really delicious stuff that they really enjoy.
Yeah, going back to the gophers, one of the things that somebody brought up was, well, this could, trying to make get something positive out of a negative situation. So people were saying, well, this could be a way to actually spread things like clover, that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't know if there's anything to that, but I thought, well, that's a good way to maybe get something positive out of something that can be a real pain in the butt.
Yeah, so these are pocket gopher mounds. So they dig up a bunch of dirt. They make a big pile of fresh dirt on the surface. And so in a place where your grasses are really established and it's hard for new things to find the soil, here's a, foot by foot, 2 foot by 2 foot square of light, fluffy dirt that you could put seeds in. And I have thought about that. It was good to be reminded of it, of like, oh yeah, that'd be fun. I could do that.
They've kind of done some tillage for you, I guess, is one way to look at it. Was there any other big or even smaller questions that you were hoping to answer before you decided to host this?
One of the questions, when I talk to people who aren't on the farm and I say, my pasture's sad, how do I improve it? They say, oh, bunch your animals up and move them faster. And I have always found the 100,000 pounds per acre really intimidating, because I have currently 4,000 pounds of sheep and that will be 7,000 pounds of sheep by the time the lambs are grown. And so to get from 7,000 pounds to 100,000 pounds, you have to condense them so much. And so we did the math and stood out in a square of okay, how much is this? With the flock that you have, how much fence do you put up to get them in that area? Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful to be like, all right, 42 feet by 42 feet. Like, yes, that's really small, but that is doable. I could do that. And so now I feel like when someone says bunch them up and move them faster, at least I'm like, okay, I know what that means. I know what they think that means. So I'm excited to try it on a small scale. It sounds like a lot of work, but...
Well, that dovetails nicely with this kind of the second part of the tour was we went down to a lower pasture here where you have your flock with the newborn lambs and two guard llamas, and with electronet, a paddock that you'd made with electronetting. And there was a very passionate discussion, it was a fascinating discussion, and I couldn't frankly follow a lot of it because math is my weak point, about, okay, here's how you calculate. And at one point, we even had some of the folks go out and physically walk out what size of paddock you would need to get that density. I guess that was kind of the idea, and to show you, to give you a visual. I thought that was a really neat way to do it, just kind of off the cuff people did that. I mean, is that something that was really helpful for you to kind of, like you said, okay, now this is what they're talking about when they, a certain size of paddock and a certain kind of density?
Yes, absolutely, because it has felt like there was the follow-up then of like, okay, this is the shape and the size. How do you do that efficiently? Because working with ElectroNet is very different from running like a single wire for cattle. It's a lot more work. It's clumsy. It's heavy. It's not that heavy. It's probably similar heavy, but it's a pain in the butt to work with. And you have these set lengths that you have to work with. And so I think every time someone had said, oh, it's bunch them up and move them faster, I was just like, I can't do that efficiently with my fences. And so then to have the shape of this is what it is, and then the follow-up of like, okay, but we recognize how much work that is. Let's troubleshoot and figure out how you can do that. That has been incredibly helpful, sort of mind-blowing to be like, I could do this.
and to be clear, the folks who participated in this, there was a couple of sheep producers like yourself, but then there was people who aren't doing beef, doing other livestock type of things. And so some of this is universal as far as grazing, but some of it is specific to sheep production. But I think one thing that is kind of universal is this idea of how can you get a better return on investment by making the best use of that forage and also kind of fit those, your values or your goals of protecting that soil and that kind of thing. I mean, that I think that just to... Sometimes you can see these groups get together and they're all raising the same breed of livestock or they're doing the same kind of farming. That's great. But I wonder if it's useful sometimes to get in different ideas from different people who are working with different species, that type of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially having a mix of cattle people and sheep people and then some people who have both cattle and sheep. It was really, I was not the only one. I don't think I was the first one who said, like, that's a ton of work. Trying to do a 42 by 42 foot square, which is really nice because for some reason, the smaller the animal, the harder they are to fence. And so cattle folks obviously need more land than I do with sheep, but they have some of the easier fencing. And so they have just like so much more flexibility in how they fence. It was really nice to also have a mix of people who, yeah, just a mix of folks who graze different pastures and different animals but share these common ideals and then are able to like talk about the different equipment and the different pieces of infrastructure and really problem solve like, all right, what would that look like on your system with the time that you have available?
And then it switched to talking about marketing, disease, dealing with disease issues. Yeah, just it was just a real range of, because when you get people together like that, they just kind of start bouncing stuff off of each other. It can be overwhelming sometimes, but it just seemed like people were able to kind of get some ideas. It was almost like brainstorming in the field, but it wasn't just like, I got this great idea that has no basis in anything, but it's something they've tried or they've heard about something somebody else has done or whatever. And it kind of just feeds on itself a little bit, it seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. At one point, we started talking about like financial stability, and someone brought up the fact that some financial advisor had basically told them like, well, you could move to a place where farmland is cheaper. And I just feel like that comes from such a lack of understanding of how important it is to have peers, both like people, like it's prime hay cutting season. Mm. I was amazed by the number of people who came today. Yeah, and frankly, like very touched that people made the time. Like this week looks beautiful for hay. I was like, we're going to get like 5 people and that's going to be great. But no, to have 17 people who believe that this sharing of information is important and that these people, like whether you're the host or you're someone who's attending, you're going to get a lot out of one of these visits. Yeah, just like the value and the power of not being alone, of like, I'm the only person grazing in the way that I'm grazing for miles. And so really nice to have a bunch of other people come and like share their experience and talk about marketing and hear that other people have had really weird health stuff come up this year in their flocks. And yeah, just really great.
Yeah, it's not just the technical expertise sharing. It's just that networking of the community, kind of building that community kind of sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. I even asked one of the people who was a little too slow to leave if he would show me how to check the oil in my tractor, and he was so nice about it.
See? There you go. I mean, it's like, well, one of the things kind of, I realized one of the things that, and I've seen this at other hub meetings that we've had, people, and sometimes they're a little bit embarrassed to bring up some of these kind of values that are important to them. You know, it's obviously one of your main goals is to make enough money to pay your mortgage and to make this viable economically. But I've seen this at other meetings too. People will start bringing up things like, well, I would like this to be ecologically regenerative, or I would, you know, soil health is such a key thing. But you can justify the soil health a lot by saying, well, it does feed into the economic viability of this operation. But one of the things, it sounds like wildlife habitat was something that, can you talk a little bit about that? Because we're here in the Blufflands. This is a beautiful area, highly erosive land, but it's gorgeous. And there's, I have the Merlin app, and I had it going in the thing, and it was going crazy. The number of birds, grassland songbirds that were, there was an indigo bunny, and I don't know if I heard an indigo bunny, and I did see it, actually. I thought, was that an indigo bunny? And in the Merlin app said it was. Anyway, and people did kind of address that a little bit, like, well, return on investment is key, but how is that going to fit in with these other goals that you have, maybe kind of that are more environmentally based or ecologically based kind of thing?
Yeah, I love working with the sheep on habitat restoration. They are just so good at it. Like, people usually think about goats as doing brush removal. The sheep won't reach as far as the goats, but they will strip every single leaf off of a honeysuckle, off of buckthorn. They love eating wild parsnip, which is obviously not in the woods, but they love eating garlic mustard at the right time. Like, it's just such a fun puzzle to try and figure out how to best use their instincts and what they like to eat and sort of like direct their amazing potential. And I just really find, like, I'm the child of hippies. And so, like, really love being outside, really love diversity, really find amazement in all the different insects and birds. My landlord said when they moved here 15 years ago, there were 13 pairs of nesting meadowlarks just along the driveway. Mm. It's a very long driveway, but still, and they are gone now. There's just not enough biological activity, I think, to keep them interested and keep them happy here. So last year I heard two of them singing for like a month, and I was so excited, but they didn't nest. So they were checking it out. They're telling us we're going the right direction, but more work needs to be done here. Yeah, they're just, I love that diversity, and they feel like such a, like, what a beautiful congratulations for hard work to be like, look at these birds that are incredibly threatened, think it's nice enough to live here.
Yeah. That's a really good way to put that. I like that. Congratulations. Speaking of land access. Yeah, so you're 34. I consider you a beginning farmer then. And so land access is a big, big issue. But one of the things you talked about, and there was a lot of interest in this, was you're kind of utilizing a program that you said you don't think maybe you would be able to take this on if you didn't have it. Could you describe this program? I think it's a really and it kind of balances your goals of habitat restoration too, it sounds like.
Yeah, so to give people some perspective, 15 years ago or 10 years ago, woods and pasture was around 2,500 an acre. It's currently 6,000 an acre.
Wow.
So it's this huge, very rapid jump that's really hard to afford. And so went looking for a conservation easement, and ended up being accepted. Our application was accepted into a Reinvest in Minnesota easement through the Bureau of Water and Soil Resources. And it's a grazing land specific one. So 37-ish of the 52 acres on this side of the creek are going into that easement. And the only thing that is allowed in those areas is grazing. So no fruit trees, no vegetables, like nothing but animals grazing. Yeah, I feel like easements can be a really great tool. Depending, each program is really different, how long it takes, how much they give you, when they know how much they're going to give you, when they know if they'll accept your project or not. So they can be a really great tool, and they can be really complicated. Mm. This easement takes a full year from when they accept your project to when the paperwork is done, mm-hmm. and the farm is not allowed to change hands in the middle of that. So the value of that easement was $150,000, which is huge. It's an incredible reduction in price. And that's a payment that goes to the landlords. And like, they had to be willing to wait an entire year to actually close on the property, which is amazing that they were willing to do that. Yeah. The thing that is really interesting about easements is it's looking like they don't actually reduce the value of the property. And so they're this really interesting tool where you put this easement on and that allows one farmer to get access. But then in the future, the next farmer has no option. Like, the next farmer can't put an easement on and then pay get this $150,000 discount. It's a value of mine and my family's. And so everybody wants that value to transfer to the next person. But I feel like that needs to be a part of the conversation with easements, is they are this incredible tool and they have some limitations and some things that, like, they're new enough that we're just not sure how that's going to look.
Yeah. I mean, it's really exciting. You don't want to get too, you don't want to promote it too much, because there are some, for one thing, this worked because you had a relationship already with these landowners. So they were willing to wait. They liked what you were doing, obviously. So they were willing to wait for this. Also, let's keep in mind, it's permanent, right? And did I get this right that, so part of the restriction is it can only be, as far as agriculture goes, in grazing, like even vegetable production, something like that would be restricted. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So on the 37 acres that are in the easement, which is a combination of woods and pasture, grazing is the only allowable thing. So on this property, we left about 13 acres out with the hopes that that gives the next farmer enough flexibility to do whatever they need to do to be able to afford to live here. The nice thing about this property is the acres that got left out really are the only ones that are appropriate for other things. It's steep enough here that even growing fruit trees, like, you wouldn't be able to run a tractor between rows. So for this property, it was a really good fit. But there are less restrictive agriculture easements. This was one where it was grazing only, which worked really well for me because that's what I want to do and what this property needs. Yeah. For the rest of the lifetime of the United States, this land can only be grazed, which is crazy.
Yeah, it is. But looking around here, I'm like, well, this is what this should be, is grazing. And not just any old kind of grazing, but, I mean, do they require a certain kind of grazing plan, or do you have to graze it in a certain way? You're not just turning the livestock out in the spring and bringing them back in the fall kind of thing? Is it a certain kind of grazing that you're supposed to be doing here?
Yeah, so you get a grazing plan, and they care that the way that they're measuring that you are grazing responsibly is by residue height. Hmm. So they should be able to come out to your farm at any point in the season and not find grass that's less than 4 to 6 inches tall. Some flexibility for winter grazing or bale grazing, but you have to be able to explain how what you did is beneficial to habitat and soil health, and then they can work with you on that. If you do accidentally get your residue too short or create like a muddy area or a high traffic area, then they'll work with you to make sure that you fix that, but you must leave long enough grass.
They kind of grade, like, how do I say this? They kind of come in and gauge how much you're going to get through this easement or how much of a relief you're going to get based on the ecological benefits or the kind of how environmentally vulnerable it is. Is that right? That kind of they grade it on certain levels. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that they were looking at for that?
Yeah, so each easement is valued differently. This Reinvested Minnesota Grazing Lands program, the payment amount is 50% of the tax value of the land. So that worked to my advantage because my landlords also had a crop field. And so that value was all just averaged. So even though the base value per acre or the average value per acre was much higher than it would have been if this was just a piece of pasture, in terms of whether or not they pick your project, they rank you on all these different things. Yeah. So size of your project, proximity to other protected land, there's a trout easement here already, areas of significant biological concern interest or something. Highly erodible land gets you more points. So there's all these, being a beginning farmer gets you more points. So all these different things that you get ranked on to decide whether or not they want to put the funds towards your project.
So you're kind of the test case for it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good to see. It'll be exciting to see if we see more of those, because anything we can help with land access is major. And I love the idea that it can fit in with regenerative grazing so well. That's a really nice fit that way. I wanted to go back a little bit, if I could, to marketing, and because that fits in with your economic goals, obviously. Can you talk a little bit about how you're doing your marketing now, where your markets are, and maybe how that would, you said at the outset that you're going to have to double your flock. Like, how big is your flock now?
30.
So you have 30 ewes. Yeah, talk a little bit about your marketing now and kind of how that, if you were to double your flock, what maybe some things you'd have to keep in mind, because it's just like, okay, I got to find a market for double that many of animals, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so if pasture is my primary weak link, I think marketing is my second growth area. I currently market wholes, halves, and a first-time buyer kit, which is essentially a quarter lamb. Most of my customers are in the Twin Cities and have been found through word of mouth, or I teach cooking classes up there. Some of them are lamb classes, others are Norwegian specialties. Mm-hmm. But I give a little blurb about, if you want some lamb, here's my email list. marketing. So my customers care that it's 100% grass-fed. Some of them really care that about the habitat stuff. Some care that I'm a beginning farmer. They all care about taste. I think the lamb is delicious, if I do say so myself.
I'll vouch for that because I just had some. It was delicious.
Right now, last year I marketed 25 lambs. And if I double my flock, I need to market around 78 a year. Okay. So obviously I need a lot more customers and I need more whole lamb customers than first-time buyer kit customers, which is the other reason that I'm really grateful for this 5 years to grow. There is this really frustrating pinch point of if you're a beginning farmer, you need to be growing your market so that you can afford to buy somewhere, but you can't really afford to invest in a place you're renting because what if you don't get to live, like be there for the full return, but you can't pay for anything if you don't have a big enough market. So it's very exciting and a little scary to be like, okay, we have 5 years, let's go. Let's really focus on this. And how can you find customers who are excited about lamb, and lamb is a more expensive meat than others because of, you know, the pasture time and mostly the processing is more expensive.
There was a really good discussion about, because we really saw the spectrum of people who have, some are direct marketing, some are kind of selling into specialty markets, some are still taking them to the sale barn or whatever. So you got that kind of, it felt like to me anyway, a real spectrum of, for somebody who is thinking about, where am I going? What's the next steps for marketing? That maybe that was some good input there.
Yeah, there's a range of options of what you can do with your lambs. And then once you've picked a sales channel, so for example, one of the things people were recommending I look into is, okay, I don't have enough pasture now. There is a subset of customers who need the lamb to be 100% grass-fed, but then I could grow faster. I could grow the flock more before I have the customer base to match it if I was to take animals to the sale barn. Mm-hmm. Those animals don't need to be grass-fed because there's no way to pass that information on to the buyer at the sale barn. And so does it make sense to like take a subset off, the ones that are growing slower, and start giving them a little bit of grain as a way to like have more animals and more animal impact now that will help the pasture and help me transition back to being 100% grass-fed flock? But is there this sort of like in-between space where I could reach my habitat goals faster by feeding a little bit of grain? And that's something that I have thought about, but have found like the math to be a little overwhelming. So it was nice to have other people be like, no, you should look at that. It's worth looking at.
No, it's good. It's good. And there's not saying you should do this, but it's like, there's all these ideas out there and you can take them for what they're worth, kind of thing. Do you have an off-farm job? Is that right? Where do you work?
So I work during the summer. I work 2 days of prep and 2 days of service at Luna Valley Pizza Farm in Decorah.
Oh, yeah.
And then every weekend between Thanksgiving and the first weekend of the year, I teach lefse and krumkaka classes up in the cities.
Oh.
And so that's my other like chunk of income for the year.
So yeah, you've got a little bit of financial cushion there. But that's what I guess my question was, are you able to kind of lift your head up from the grindstone enough to say, well, this is where I'd like to be? And of course, in 5 years, you want to have enough return on investment to start paying off these loans and everything. But kind of even beyond that, is this something do you think maybe it could be something that is providing all your income, or are you still kind of open about that?
I am an extrovert, so I like having the structure of going to a job where there are other people. And it's nice to have some amount of steady income. So I see this forever as being like part-time off farm and then, you know, more than part-time on farm with a mix of like ag tourism or other classes. So trying to get a lot of income streams, but I really appreciate both the people piece and then the stability of an off-farm job. Also being able to go somewhere where you don't have to make all the decisions.
Yeah.
I love that.
The sheep don't get out at work. You don't have to deal with that. So I just have a final question, kind of a general question. We kind of been touching on this a little bit, but this idea of peer-to-peer learning, I mean, that must be so key. And I know you took Farm Beginnings, and that's a real focus of that. And you also, when you were on the incubator farm at Dana's, you saw that kind of a different way of doing that as well. But this peer-to-peer learning, I mean, it's so cool to see somebody who took Farm Beginnings and has kind of been transitioning more and more into this, to then now be part of this, which is kind of our newest iteration of peer-to-peer learning, and farmer-to-farmer networking, these hubs kind of thing. But it must be kind of fun to be part of that, I would think, and to And I know you alluded to earlier that sometimes the information you get from the so-called experts through the agencies and that type of thing isn't as helpful as it could be, frankly. So it must be neat to be part of this, I guess, to be able to get that information from other folks who are kind of dealing with, and some of them are older, you know, and are in different stages of their farming careers, but to get that spectrum, you know, there was some younger farmers here as well.
I was talking with one of the hub members, Damien, today about how hard it is to find intermediate level training. Because, yeah, you're just like everyone's coming at a different point, and intermediate is such a wide, you're in intermediate for such a long time. Uh-huh. And this feels like one of those places of just like you can build relationships with folks over time so that everybody understands a little bit more about where you're coming from and what your level is. And like this feels like intermediate learning, whereas like a grazing school, they just start with the basics so often that it ends up not being a great use of time or resources. So these peer-to-peer groups are really incredible because they fill that niche of intermediate. And obviously there's people in the group who are very advanced, but hopefully because there's enough variables. One, it's hopefully fun that we all really respect their advice and want to hear from them, but also hopefully they get a little weird tidbit every once in a while.
So anything you're going to immediately try to put into place or change, or are you still going to kind of contemplate some of the things that you learned today?
Definitely need to contemplate more. It was recommended that I plant chicory and plantain, and I think that feels very doable for next spring. I am very curious about trying the bunch them up and move them faster. Like people have been saying that for years, and every year I think I get closer and closer and think I'm doing it, and people say, no, more, bunch them up more. So I am excited to try that at least on a small scale, even if I just do it for like 3 days, just to see what that does long term.
Little steps, and then you get that confidence, and then you pull that trigger and move them.
Yes, yeah.
When did you take Farm Begains?
2015.
I just was going to ask you, so is there anything do you still retain from that class or that was helpful for you right now as you're getting more than a decade into kind of this farming dream of yours a little bit? Is there still some things you retain from Farm Beginnings?
I really appreciated that Farm Beginnings starts with values. Like, why are you doing this and what do you want from your life? So that is still very much top of mind. And then the financial training of just like, here's how you do a holistic financial plan. Here's how you keep records. Here's how you like do books. I talked with another beginning farmer. And now I'm like the level one farm finance trainer in Grow Your Green from Minnesota Farmers Market Association.
Oh, great.
And that's, you know, in part mostly thanks to that basis of knowledge from Land Stewardship Project. And I was working with a beginning farmer in there, and she's like, did you have any idea when we started that you were going to have to keep books? And I was like, yeah, because I took Farm Beginnings. It's a wonderful program.
Episode 265 of Ear to the Ground features a 2021 discussion about Heidi Eager's experience on the Nettle Valley Farm incubator operation. For a link to that podcast and more information on how LSP's soil health hubs help build soil health profitably, utilizing practices like managed rotational grazing, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 406 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. We'd like to note that this episode, just like all Ear to the Ground podcasts, is the product of work done by real humans. Generative artificial intelligence, also known as generative AI, plays no part in the recording or editing of these shows. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.